From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Music journalist Tom Doyle joins me this week. Tom Doyle is a long-standing contributing editor to Q Magazine, and his work has also appeared in Mojo and lots of other places. And when a magazine like that has a cover on Keith Richards or Kate Bush, Elton John, R.E.M., U2, or Sir Paul McCartney, the chances are Tom Doyle is the writer of the profile. His latest book is Man on the Run, Paul McCartney in the 1970s. And it is the best book on Paul McCartney so far. Tom Doyle, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me on.
You know, I want my listeners to know why I praise your book so highly. First of all, your book starts in 1969. Every other book on Paul McCartney is like two-thirds over by the time it gets to 1969. You focus on the years in which Paul McCartney really established himself as a performer and a creative artist after the Beatles, which was no easy act to follow. And your book avoids being judgmental, which for some reason all of the books about Paul McCartney and the Beatles tend to be, beginning with Philip Norman's Shout. There's been this tendency to lionize John and belittle the accomplishments of Paul. For example, in a recent biography of Paul, somebody called the song Magneto and Titanium Man unlistenable. And I've always sort of liked that song, particularly enjoyed it when I saw him perform it live at the Cow Palace in 1976. And in your book, you mention the song in the context of an album that you'd call stylistically adventurous. And I appreciated your objective approach to the music and to the man. So thank you for writing the book.
Well, that's great to hear that, actually. Yeah, I mean, I think, obviously, I mean, Lennon, it's one of these horrible things, really. I mean, I suppose the circumstances of his really horrible, brutal murder tends to sort of canonize him, you know. And, I mean, I've interviewed Yoko, I've been into the Dakota apartment and stuff like that, and, I mean, even she would say that John was a really difficult man at times, you know. I suppose with this book, I was kind of trying to sort of redress the balance a bit. The thing is, I'm a massive Lennon fan and stuff like that as well, you know, and hopefully he comes out of the book well. But I really, with this book, wanted to shine a light on McCartney in the 70s, just really because I felt that the biographies that I'd read of him, understandably, when they got to the Beatles split, kind of just glossed over the 70s in sort of 100, 150 pages, something like that. And basically, I first met Paul, we find ourselves talking about the 70s a lot, right, because of the ongoing sort of reissue program of his albums from that period. And for me, a different kind of McCartney was emerging, and this is really the McCartney that I wanted to shine a light on.
So I want to hear more about, before we talk about the material in your book, you got to talk to Paul, you know, which is, that's something I haven't had the opportunity to do, although, you know, I've heard him speak a million times. And one of the great things about the interviews that you conducted is you got him to talk about things, or you got him to say new things, because he always kind of says the same old thing in most of his interviews. So what was it like to talk to him? How did that work?
Well, I mean, the prologue of the book basically just documents the different times that I met him, you know. I mean, not all the times I met him, actually, but it documents how the relationship developed, this working relationship that we'll have. And the first time I met him was in 2006, which was the 20th anniversary of Q Magazine, and they were having lots of different people on the cover, 20 people on the cover, and Paul was one of them, right? So I go to meet him in this photo studio in North London. And he's great. He's sort of laid back and, hey, whatever, you know, as I'd expected him to be. I mean, I'd interviewed a lot of people at that time, but having been a Beatles nut, I must admit I had to go and have two beers before I went to interview him. No, we had half an hour, but during this half an hour, I mean, he kept on looking at his watch. And, you know, he was really nice and blah, 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 but I was thinking, you know this man, I mean, I'm not completely engaging this guy. 2 days later, the announcement was made that he was divorcing Heather Mills. So, obviously, it was like, well, this guy's head was partly somewhere else. So I was given the opportunity to meet him again 16 months later. And I decided, having read a lot of, you know, the interviews that he'd done in the previous 10 years or whatever, you know, I mean, it was so reverential, really. And just, it's one of those things, you just ask him a question and they just allow him to talk, you know, which is fair enough because of, you know, the huge personality and, you know, legend that he is and stuff. But being a bit of a cheeky Scottish dude, I decided to go in there and basically be a cheeky Scottish dude. So this was it, you know, and I mean, so I was in there and sort of piss-taking a bit, and, then, you know, suddenly he was doing it back, you know, I mean, he's got a great Scottish accent that he does. So he'd be ribbing me, I'd be ribbing him, but also I'd be trying to push him, you know, it's one of those things, particularly with people who've been interviewed lots and lots. You tend to sort of start, you ask them a question and then you think, God, I've heard this before. So sometimes, and this is quite rude really, you know, but I would crash the answer and I'd go, yeah, but anyway, what about blah, blah, blah. And he actually responded quite well to this. I mean, sometimes, you know, with humour, sometimes he'd get annoyed, right? But that's kind of part of the interview process and stuff like that as well. And from this point on, I mean, actually when I left, his publicist turned to me and he said, I think he enjoyed that. And I went back there, I think it was the week after or whatever, and carried on just doing this same thing. And I suppose what it was revealing to me was the sort of working class macker who is never really too far from the surface. But, I mean, he's a great PR man and stuff, you know, so he tends to just, as you would imagine, just, you know, trot out basically pat answers a lot of the time. So I felt that this sort of cheekier approach was really starting to yield results. And this is, I suppose, why I've ended up interviewing him, you know, two or three times a year since then.
We're talking with Tom Doyle, and his new book is a book about Paul McCartney called Man on the Run, Paul McCartney in the 1970s. I particularly liked it when you talked to him about his famous thumbs up. You know, whenever there's a camera on him, he turns and smiles and puts his thumbs up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is it. I mean, it was quite surprising because as I write in the book, you know, I just mentioned it sort of casually. I mean, I suppose the question that I was trying to ask was, this is quite a handy sort of two-dimensional image, really. It's like, oh, here's wacky thumbs aloft Maca and always chirpy and cheery and stuff like that. And I was saying, but this is quite handy, really, you know, because it can kind of mask the guy who is controlling or bitter or angry or whatever, you know, because it's just, here we go, it's thumbs aloft Maca. Surprising me, it absolutely lit his fuse and he just went off into this really sweary rant, you know, about, I mean, it's hard to describe really. I mean, I suppose it's just he doesn't want to be reduced to that sort of two-dimensional image. And, I mean, I'll do, you know, for your listeners, I'll not go into all the swearing. I mean, it's all the bit, you know. But it quite surprised me. And obviously, when something like that happens, as an interviewer, one of the things that I enjoy doing, right, is laughing, you know. Mm-hmm. So I thought this was hilarious, man, you know. And it's always a good response, you know, particularly when somebody gets angry, just to laugh. Because, I mean, then it becomes a sort of comedy rage. And really, that's what it was for him, you know. So, yeah, I mean, he absolutely hates that. I mean, he said to me, have you seen me do it in the last 10 years? And I was like, actually, no, you're right, man. You know, you haven't done it. He's like, that's because I've been chasing the bat. What old opinion on this and stuff? So it was very, very funny. It was a funny moment.
Well, in your book, your book kind of begins with Paul McCartney in really, really bad shape. And nobody's ever really delved into that before. I mean, Paul has kind of, you know, hinted at it, but Paul, he's not very forthcoming with his emotions, which, you know, why should he be? Mm-hmm. But you really painted a picture of him that was pretty glum in 1969.
Well, you've got to imagine, I mean, you put yourself in this guy's position, you know, he's been one of the most famous faces on earth, you know. I mean, he's come out of this absolutely golden run, right, with the Beatles. He's only 27. I mean, this is amazing to think about it, right? But, I mean, he's only 27. And suddenly Lennon, who has been becoming increasingly difficult and stuff, and also was at this point a junkie, right? So, I mean, I've had a few junkie mates and stuff. It's impossible to deal with them, really. Has announced in September 69 at this Beatles meeting, look, that's it, I'm out the band, I want a divorce, it's over. And Paul, I mean, he's trying to hold it together and stuff like that, but this news really is crushing to him. And I suppose one of the interesting things for me in the book, and this particular point, is that if you look at Paul in the Let It Be film, he seems supremely confident to the point of arrogance, and he's irritating George, and Lennon's staring on, skagged out, sort of doesn't even want to engage anymore and stuff like that. So, I mean, I suppose he is seen as being the guy with Let It Be who hogged the camera because he had this massive ego and blah, blah, blah. Now, that may be true, right? But September 69 and that period through 69 and 70, even into 71, he really struggled, actually, you know, because of, it is that thing, isn't it? I mean, confidence is sometimes front, isn't it? And so I think there was a lot of that going on. And with the crash of the Beatles and the fact that he was basically redundant, but he couldn't tell anyone about this, I think it was just an absolute personal crisis, a crash. I mean, he says, I almost had a nervous breakdown. But the thing is, I mean, if the symptoms of a nervous breakdown are the fact that you can't function, you don't want to get out of bed and stuff, then this is exactly what was happening to Paul. So, I mean, it's a strange place to start a book in a way, but I suppose it's revealing because of the fact that it's a completely different side of his character.
I've always wondered what Paul was thinking. You know, I remember the time really well, and I enjoyed the solo albums that the Beatles were making, but of course I thought they were vastly inferior to the Beatles albums. I mean, I think, you know, the best solo album of any Beatle is inferior to the worst Beatles album, if there is such a thing. But, you know, but I was particularly wondering, you know, how did Paul feel when he heard How Do You Sleep from John Lennon's Imagine album? I mean, that's a pretty mean-spirited... A few years ago, an instrumental version of How Do You Sleep was released, and it's like, oh, that's a pretty good song. Too bad it didn't have a better lyric, because that lyric is so mean. So how did Paul take it when he heard that?
Oh, well, I mean, obviously it crushed him, you know, because the fact, obviously, him and Lennon had been mates, childhood friends, you know, and suddenly it's this, has it come to this? I mean, to be fair, actually, with Ram, there was coded little snipes in there, you know, just tiny, tiny wee things. It was pretty mild, really. And obviously, look, this is the thing with Lennon, you know, he's one of these guys, if you poke a stick, you know, into that bear cage, I mean, you're going to get your arm torn off. And I mean, really, that's what happened, you know.
And I suppose you took your lucky break and broke it in two or whatever.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, all that stuff, you know, and preaching practices in too many people and stuff. I mean, that was Paul's dig at him, you know. But, I mean, it's pretty mild. And obviously, they'd had this stuff, you know, where they're slating each other in the press and all this stuff. So, I mean, it did. It crushed him, you know. And actually, I mean, he did admit, it was just like, maybe I am this turd that he's saying, you know. I mean, maybe I am this straight, horrible dude and all this sort of stuff. So, you know, with Wings Wildlife, he writes Dear Friend, which is, as he points out in the book, he says, it was a lot more loving. And, I mean, I think, really, at that point, that was the beginning of them saying, both of them saying, look, man, let's not do this. I mean, this is just crazy.
Did John Lennon ever express, to your knowledge, publicly that How Do You Sleep was a piece of shit or whatever?
Well, he regretted it. I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, he said, look, it was something done in a moment of anger. He said, but hey, listen to Ram, folks. It was basically like, look, Paul started it.
You know, when I hear the... recently, the podcaster was made available of Lennon Remembers, like the tapes of Lennon speaking in what became the Rolling Stone interview and then the famous book, Lennon Remembers. And when you hear John talking, you know, it's kind of funny. But when you read it and you don't have his... a good-natured voice behind it, that's also pretty grim. That must have been a kind of a blow, too.
Well, it was an argumentative dude, obviously. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, if you hear... I mean, this is the thing, I interview people all the time, and sometimes it's strange when you transcribe things and you think, wow, you know, I mean, those words out of the context of the character and the way that they were said and stuff like that seem much harsher or colder. And I think, actually, you're right about that. I mean, that definitely happened with that interview, because there was a lot of humour as well in what Lennon was doing. I mean, he was totally baiting McCartney. But, man, that was the only guy that Lennon was baiting. Lennon was baiting the world, you know, for a peacenik, man. He was an angry dude. But also, I mean, there's a really funny point that, you know, that McCartney talks about when they were arguing at one point. And Lennon apparently just took his glasses down and looked at Paul and said to him, hey, man, it's only me. So Lennon was definitely what we would call, right, in Scotland, a wind-up merchant, you know, somebody who loves to just crank people up just to see what they do, you know. And I suppose it is a pretty sadistic pleasure, but Lennon definitely had that. He was a very complex man, as is McCartney.
Yeah, I think that's one of the interesting things that comes out of your book, Man on the Run, Paul McCartney in the 70s, is how complex Paul is. He's not this simpleton that maybe he would even have people believe.
Well, he's got this sort of doe-eyed image, and, look at the wacky thumbs aloft thing that we talked about earlier. He's seen as being very controlling, which, any sort of band leader or, songwriter is. I mean, practically everyone that I've met who is in that role has this sort of controlling nature about them and stuff. But I suppose the things that, when I said earlier that a different McCartney was emerging in my eyes, part of it was this sort of lack of confidence, this insecurity. I mean, Linda did say that those early Wings years and stuff were a terribly insecure period for him. But I suppose the key that really is the key to me understanding him and wanting to write the book was I thought, he's quite eccentric, really. And that is never seen in his personality, really. He's seen as being very straight ahead, knows exactly what he's doing. And for me, this eccentricity kind of was the key to everything. Once it was like, wow, it explains things like Uncle Albert, which was like a US number one, written about his Uncle Albert, things like Mullican Tyre. I mean, Mary Had a Little Lamb. You think, why is this guy making these records? And I suppose this sort of mild eccentricity is the reason for this, actually.
Well, like a song like Silly Love Songs. Silly Love Songs is a song, aside from being a record. It's not a particularly, incredibly great song. It's not a terrible song. But the record is one of the greatest records ever made. It's like this incredible little symphony with all these little parts to it.
Well, this is it. Paul's obviously always been into his classical stuff, right? And, that is like a little pocket symphony, as Brian Wilson would put it, But, that's the thing. That's an interesting record in itself because, he's defying his critics who are saying, you just toss off all these soft rock, love songs and stuff like that. And, that's a song within a song. It's almost like a Hall of Mirrors thing, isn't it?
Right. Right, yeah, it's a meta songwriting.
Yep.
Yeah, it's I've always been an admirer of his solo work, and I've never all the way through. I always thought there was always wonderful, great things that people never heard. Things like "Cafe on the Left Bank" or just some odd little songs that are just beautifully done.
Oh, totally. I mean, there's things like, even on Back to the Egg, there's a track there called Arrows Through Me, right?
I love that.
Nobody would know that track, actually. I'm amazed that you do, in a way, but that's him basically doing that sort of Hall & Oates thing, right? And it's gorgeous. It's absolutely brilliant.
His bass playing on that particular song is like, he's like the bass is the lead guitar, and he's just, he's the greatest bass player ever, but it's
absolutely is. It's worth just sometimes, right, listening to Revolver, or particularly Sergeant Pepper, where he spent a lot of time. He would stay late after the band had left and stuff and work really hard on the bass lines. It's worth actually just putting that album on and just listening to the bass lines, all the way through, because, it really reveals a lot about where his head was at and stuff like that. But, obviously that classical sensibility is a really strong thing in McCartney's songwriting.
Yeah, on Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, which we think of as a John Lennon song, but if you just focus on the bass, it's so musical and harmonic.
This is it. It's like a melodic lead line, basically. It's, a counterpoint melody, really. But, something like Rain, listen to the bass line on that, and it's like, wow. Lots of different facets to his character and musicality.
And, and adventuresome. That is, just because he did this album doesn't mean that the next album will be exactly like that. I was also struck by his desire to keep Wings together. His current band that he tours with, I think that's the band he's been with the longest of any band he's been in his whole life.
Yeah, what a great band as well. Really the best band that he's had in his solo years. I think the thing with Wings, it was a tough thing, right? Because, I do ask him about this in the book, and it's just like, it was like a revolving door policy you had for that band, right? Why couldn't you keep the lineup together? And he just laughed and he said, musical differences, right? Which is obviously the part line. There's obviously a lot more to it and stuff. And in the research of the book, what I think was revealed was the fact that he chose these people to join the band on their musical ability over their personalities, really. Or he didn't look too strongly into their personalities. I mean, you know, somebody like Jimmy McCulloch, who's an amazing guitarist. This is the guy that was in basically the second lineup of Wings. And, you know, this amazing young Scottish guitarist. But, I mean, Jimmy McCulloch basically warns McCartney really early on. It's just like, look, you know, I mean, if I've had my intoxicants, there's a bit of a Jekyll and Hyde thing to me. And McCartney more or less just says, oh, I'm all like that, and dismisses it, and off they go. And this causes massive problems in the future. And, you know, the same thing had happened with Henry McCulloch, no relation, right? But the same thing, right? Henry liked to drink and liked, you know, a puff and all this sort of stuff. And but then, obviously, it didn't really, you know, it affected his character in negative ways. And so McCartney's trying throughout Wings, right, to lock in a lineup, but it's not quite happening. At certain times, the guitarists are having a go at Linda over her musical skills or lack of, depending on, you know, which perspective you have. And I suppose this is the real problem with Wings, is that Paul is trying not to be the band leader, but really, because of his nature and because of his past, it's impossible for him to do this. I mean, there's one part in the book where Glyn Johns is brought in to produce Red Rose Speedway, and he says to, and Paul says to Glyn, he says, look, just treat me as any band member. Now, Glyn Johns, having a bit of an attitude about him, really starts to do this, and Paul doesn't like it. It's just like, no, you can't talk to me like that. I'm a Beatles sort of thing. So yeah. I think Wings was a really tough thing. I think by the time he got to the last lineup of Wings, he really was tired of it and stuff. And maybe naturally, as Lennon did say after he saw the Coming Up video, where McCartney played all the different parts in the band, he said, like, this is perfect for him. He says he always wanted to be a one-man band anyway.
Although, you know, he always had Linda with him in his solo years for as long as Linda was alive. And I think Linda really added a lot to the sound. I mean, I like the Wings sound, which is very distinct from any other sound of Paul's. And, you know, he was definitely kind of distancing himself from the Beatles sound until the late 80s when he kind of re-embraced it.
Yeah, and, sure.
And that period with Linda, I think it was really wonderful. And you talk about this in the book. There's a very cruel bootleg that circulated in which Linda's vocal track had been isolated, which was completely ridiculous because she's singing in a gigantic crowd and it was totally unfair. But Linda sadly heard that bootleg.
Oh, yeah, and I mean, it, absolutely, you know, I mean, it was like, talk about crushing, really. I mean, and Paul does talk about this in the book, yeah. I mean, he says, like, somebody had isolated her vocal when she's clapping and stuff like that, trying to be the cheerleader. And really, yeah, I mean, it is awful. I mean, she does sound awful in it and stuff, and it was really horrible to hear. And he was saying, once it's out there, you can't get it back and blah, blah, blah. But that's not the only one, man. I mean, I think there's one of Ronnie Wood trying to play Jumpin' Jack Flash, and he doesn't get the riff right once.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, it is that thing. It's just like she was not alone in that. But talking to the guys who'd been in Wings and stuff, and particularly the guys who were in the first lineup, they were saying, look, Linda wasn't a necessity musically, right? But she was an absolute necessity for Paul and for the creation of that band. I mean, basically, like Dennis Hybel, the drummer in the original Wings, he said to me, look, you know, if it hadn't been for Linda, Paul would have just stayed a drunk up on the farm up in Scotland, blah, blah, blah. She pulled him out of that hole. She was the mother of his children. Also, great visual artist. This is forgotten a lot of the time. I mean, the UK version of the book has this great shot of Paul taken during the Red Rose Speedway sessions with the rose in his mouth, and it's an outtake from that. It's a great shot.
It's such a beautiful cover. Why did they use a different cover for the American release?
I just think they wanted something different, actually. Yeah, I mean, but yeah, that's a great cover. I mean, and also there's another picture which we thought about using. This is interesting, actually, because talking about Linda as a photographer, really.
Yeah.
There was a shot of Paul in a black pea coat. It was a black and white shot, standing on a hill up in Scotland, right, with the sea behind him, right? And it's a beautiful picture. And what I really liked about it, actually, was that it made him look so contemporary. I mean, he looks like, you know, a Brooklyn hipster. He looks like, you know, he looks like he could have joined Fleet Foxes or something in this shot, right? And I thought that this would make a great shot as well. And what was strange about it is because, I mean, these things were from Paul's archives at MPL. Obviously, they own all Linda's shots. And when they went back to this was one shot that was stuck on the end of a roll of film. So I don't know, we might use it in the future for something, but I mean, I suppose what I'm trying to say is that Linda was a great visual artist as well. She's, you know, I think a lot of people go, oh, she was just Paul's wife and had a camera and took some pictures of him. But actually, if you look at some of the pictures, the quality of them is amazing. So, I mean, she had all these different things that she brought to the table. I mean, you can look at the cover of Venus and Mars and stuff like that as expertly shot. It's beautiful stuff. And obviously her musical skills improved as the 70s wore on. But Paul needed her there on a number of levels, you know, for security and stuff like that, because obviously she was filling the holes in his insecurity. But also it was the post-hippie time, and he wanted his family to be like a band of gypsies and travel around with him. So that was one of the main other reasons, really, that she was on the road and on stage, because otherwise, I mean, he's not going to see her half the time. So I think it was a smart move in the long run, even if she did have a really rough time at certain points.
Speaking of her album covers, you know, she also did photographs that adorned album covers for many rock and roll artists before she ever met Paul McCartney.
Well, this is it. I mean, great photographer. I mean, really brilliant photographer. I mean, obviously, she had earned her reputation through doing that. I mean, and it's almost similar to Yoko. I mean, when I interviewed Yoko, I've done her a couple of times, but, I mean, it was particularly poignant when I did her in the Dakota, because obviously, you're sitting in their kitchen. Not much has changed, really, from the pictures that you see of them sitting there in the late 70s and stuff like that. And that's the one thing that Yoko says. You know, it's just I became Mrs. Lennon. And everything that I'd done was kind of dismissed and blah, blah, blah. And the same really did happen for Linda. It was kind of like, ah, she's just some chick with a camera. And it's like nothing could be further from the truth. She was a great photographer.
We're talking with Tom Doyle, and his new book is called Man on the Run. Paul McCartney in the 1970s. So has Paul seen the book? Do you know?
You know, that's a very good question, actually. I mean, what happened was when I told MPL and his publicist that I was going to write this book, they sort of said, great, quite vaguely. And then we were looking for shots, and they offered us, you know, all these different shots and blah, blah, blah. And so I took that as a gentle endorsement. I mean, while the book was being written, I was writing, I was doing other features, Q Mojo features with Paul, and I just never mentioned the book, and neither did he. So, but we have had sort of acknowledgement from his office and stuff like that, that they think it was great, that it looked great and stuff like that. I have no idea if he's read it. I mean, if you'd had, I don't know, a couple of hundred books written about you, would you read the latest one? I don't know, but, you know, put it this way, I've not been excommunicated, so, I mean, they're still, you know, allowing me to interview him, and they're still letting me into the shows and stuff like that. So I would take that as some kind of endorsement. I don't know what kind.
But, yeah. But he hasn't had you killed, I guess, is a good
no,
sign.
No, not yet, man. You know what I mean? Watch this space.
Well, the book is a fantastic book. I love it. It's called Man on the Run, Paul McCartney in the 1970s. Tom Doyle, thanks so much for talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
That's great, Gary. Thanks very much, man.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Tom Doyle. His new book is called Man on the Run, Paul McCartney in the 1970s. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.